All right, dear friends, Greg Kokel here on Stan the Reason. I'm glad you joined me today and looking forward to sharing some thoughts with you that I hope will be helpful for you in the long run. And what I'm going to do today is go into some depth on a topic that we touch on a fairly frequent basis and a topic that you encounter if you're a thoughtful Christian engaging others about your convictions also on a fairly regular basis. The way I often introduce this to audiences, which I did just this last weekend, for example, in Las Vegas, is I told them I want to talk about a serious problem that everyone faces, that no one escapes, and that no one can solve. But one. And that's the problem of evil. I think this is one of the most, on the one hand, most challenging issues to address as a follower of Christ or as a Christian theist. But at the same time, one of the most beneficial, oddly enough, challenges to Christianity, because I think the challenge itself tells us some very important things about the nature of reality that play in our direction as Christian theists, okay? And ironically, and I'll get to this in a bit, the details of it, even though many think of this as a good argument or good evidence against the existence of God, I actually think it is the problem of evil, one of the best evidences in favor of the existence of God, not against it. And this is what amounts to the moral argument for the existence of God. And that can be stated very, very simply in a very straightforward way. And that is, if there is no God, then there is no objective evil. But there is objective evil, i.e., the problem of evil. Therefore, there is a God. Now, that needs to be unpacked a little bit, and I want to talk about it a little bit here, but from a certain perspective. Now, many of you know that I have daughters that, right now, 14 and 11, but when my oldest was younger, she had asked me a question about the reason we are confident that God exists, or that our view is a true one. And many have heard me tell this story before, but it bears repeating because the concept that came out of it, or at least the phrasing of a concept, because I had to think about this now, how I was going to explain to my, what, 8-year-old daughter at the time, the reason that we were convinced that there was a God, or in her way of phrasing it, that God was true. How do we know that God is true, is what she asked me. And though I'm in the business of answering those kinds of questions, you can see the dilemma I'm in with all of these different things going on in my mind, these kinds of arguments that might be offered in favor of the existence of God, and them being cumbersome for the moment, and also maybe a little bit esoteric for an 8-year-old, whatever. And suddenly this phrase kind of popped into my mind. And it captured, I think, my entire approach to this whole project. And that is that the reason I told her we believe God is true is because he's the best explanation for the way things are. Okay, I want you to think about that phrase for a moment. He's the best explanation for the way things are. And so the reason I think that that's a helpful aphorism is because, first of all, I think it's true. He is the best explanation for the way things are. However, it doesn't say he's the perfect explanation for the way things are. And here I'm not going to the facts of the matter. I think God is the perfect explanation, but that doesn't mean that we have access to the details that adequately show us that he is the perfect explanation for the way things are. We have a kind of an epistemological veil there. We are limited in how we know and what we know. And so we take our best shot. And we look at the preponderance of evidence and beyond a reasonable doubt, that kind of thing. And I think then we're looking at what's the smart money, basically. What option is the smart money on? And I think the answer to that is Christian theism. And that protects me, putting it that way, because I don't have to dot every I and cross every T in order to make my case that Christianity is reasonable, and it's the best explanation. I can admit there's things I don't understand and that I don't know, or there are loose ends that I may not at this point be able to tie up. But what is the alternative? And you see, that's the kind of approach that, you know, science uses. They look at a series of events, physical events, and they ask the question, what is the best explanation for those events? And that is the whole question of explanatory power. So I think this is a principle that can apply to lots of issues. What's the best explanation for the empty tomb, for example? Or what is the best explanation for the appearance of design in the biological realm, which Richard Dawkins, the famous atheistic evolutionist, acknowledges is palpable. He starts his book, The Blind Watchmaker, with the statement, the biological realm is a complex world that gives the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. Now, he doesn't think that it was. He thinks it was not designed by the watchmaker, God, but rather by the blind watchmaker of natural selection, and whether that's adequate to do the job is another issue. But notice the point. What is the best explanation for what we encounter? Design in the universe, for example. And so this whole notion of explanatory power is critical to answering questions like this. What explanation of the world makes the best sense of, and fill in the blank. In this case, the question is, what explanation of the world makes the best sense of mind-numbing evil and suffering? Now, as I'm broadcasting, I'm just a few days shy of the 18th memorial of 9/11. In fact, driving in today, the route I take through the mountains from Conejo Valley on Malibu Canyon Road takes me to PCH and Malibu Canyon Road, which is a corner where there's a big, giant green field that's part of a grassy area, a grassy knoll that's part of Pepperdine University. And there every year at 9/11, they have a flag planted for every person who lost their life on that day. And the flag represents the nation that they were from. So it's mostly American flags, but there's a mixture, of course. It's very stunning. And we think about 9/11, we think about mind-numbing evil and also suffering that took place there. But that's not the only example. There's lots of them. And it's not surprising then when people look at things like that and they ask the question, where's God? Or actually, they ask the question, is there a God? How can we make sense of this if there is a God? I'm reminded of Meryl Streep and playing Sophie in Sophie's Choice, the film, I don't know, what is it, 30 years ago or so now, but she plays a Polish woman who survived Auschwitz, and then later in life she's not doing so well, and she, halfway through the movie or so, there's a reflection back, and now you understand why she's such a broken individual, because when she went to Auschwitz and got off the train, she had one child on either side, John, her little boy, and Eva, her daughter, and she had to make a choice which one would live and which one would die. She could only take one with her, and the one she chose was her son, which meant that Eva was escorted to crematorium too, and exterminated. And she took this as the character in the film as evidence that God didn't exist, because, as she put it, only I knew, she says, I knew that Christ had turned his face away from me and that only a Jesus who no longer cared for me could kill those people that I loved. Now, it's a dramatic and moving reflection that I think echoes the deepest doubts that we have often about God. And, of course, the way this is often presented to us is like an intellectual problem. Christianity has in it, at its core, a contradiction. And the contradiction can be stated somewhat syllogistically. I say somewhat because this isn't a very refined syllogism, but it's the way most people think about it. If God were good, he would want to get rid of all evil. If God were powerful, he'd be able to get rid of all evil. But evil still exists, obviously. And by the way, that's something that everybody knows. This is universal awareness. You can take this to the bank. Everybody knows that that the world is not the way it's supposed to be. It doesn't matter where you live in the world or when you lived in the history of the world. This is part of the human awareness. Something is wrong. And when you look at the religions of the world or the philosophies that of the world that are more secular and not religious, they are meant to in some way provide a repair for a broken world. And the repair they provide is based on what they think went wrong. Okay, here's the problem, here's the answer kind of thing. But notice they all presume that there is a problem, almost every single one. There are a few rare exceptions. But in any event, you see the point there. Everybody knows there's a problem. Evil does exist. Therefore, the syllogism continues, God is either too frail to oppose evil, he's not strong enough, or he's too sinister to care, he's not really good. Or, and this is really the default conclusion, God simply does not exist at all. And so therefore, this is the atheist's favorite argument. It's, I think, the most tenacious objection against theism of any sort. It's the one that seems the most damaging because it's a deal breaker for a lot of people. And it's a deal breaker because evil is real. And this attempt at leveraging evil against God is aggressive and adequate to defeat the Christian worldview if it goes through. That is, theism can't be true because it entails a contradiction. That's how this kind of argument works. Like I said, it's fatal if it succeeds because no worldview can be true if it entails a contradiction, at least the worldview taken as a whole. So this is the way that, in one sense, the problem is presented to the Christian to figure out. But there's something else going on here. And that is that the real problem of evil isn't really intellectual, though there is this attempt I just described and outlined, and I think it needs to be spoken to. But when the issue is raised most aggressively in people's hearts, it's not because it's intellectual, it's because it's personal. In the case of Sophie's Choice, the film, Sophie's dilemma wasn't intellectual. She wasn't pondering the law of non-contradiction. What she said was, only a Jesus who no longer cared for me could kill those people I loved. And when you and I face tragedy, and we are, and we do, I should say, we are facing, or we do face, depending. And when we are torn with anguish, and that happens even to Christians, when we cry out, where was God in the circumstances in our life? And I'm just saying, this is common, and even in my own life, I ask the same question. Where was God? Now, I'm not asking it in the same way that some do, like, where was God? He wasn't there at all because there is no God. I asked that question with a little different theological bent. Why didn't he answer that prayer or something to that effect? But the point I'm making is that anguish and difficulty and suffering are part of the common human experience, even of Christians who are faithfully serving Christ. And so questions arise in their minds as a result of that common human experience of suffering and anguish. And oftentimes that question is one that wonders whether there is a God or not. And that is the hardest one to deal with when the emotional compulsion, the set of circumstances that you're in, compels you one emotionally to wonder about the existence of God. That's the real issue. Bertrand Russell, the great 20th century British philosopher and atheist, said famously, "How can you talk about God when you're kneeling at the bed of a dying child?" 19th century French poet Baudelaire allegedly said, "If there is a God, he is a devil." So here's something that I want you to understand from the outset. There's the problem. We know it. We realize it. I'm not hiding from it. I'm not denying it. I'm not running from it. But I want to be clear about one thing from the beginning. Given that this issue is personal, when I talk about this issue, whether with an individual or with a group or on the air, or even when I struggle with it in my own heart or mind, I am not addressing the problem in the abstract as a theologian or a philosopher, but rather as a human being. I have to live in the same world you do. I have to answer the problem of evil for myself, just like you do. So in that sense, think about it. This is not a theist's problem. This is a human problem. Every human being lives in a world where there is deep evil and suffering. Dennis Prager, the talk show host, the Jewish talk show host, has put it this way. I hope I'm quoting him correctly, but you'll get the point. If suffering were water, the world would drown. So this is part of the human condition. It isn't just part of the Christian condition. And so, consequently, as a Christian, I am not the only one who must answer the challenge of the problem of evil. And this particular point, by the way, may be the most important point I make here in this time as we chat about this. I'm not the only one. The problem of evil is a problem for everyone. We all have to make sense of the way things actually are. Every person, every religion, every worldview has to grapple with this problem. So that means even the atheist has to give an account of evil in the world. And the atheist can't, in a certain sense, just complain about the problem, then turn on his heel and walk away. Because the person who gets rid of God because of the problem of evil, and I understand that, I'm sympathetic to that, I get it, but I just want to point out, they haven't gotten rid of the problem of evil. They have only gotten rid of one possible way of solving the problem. So if you're hurt by personal tragedy or corruption in the church, as some are, and you're tempted to abandon your convictions, okay, now what? What's the alternative? You still have to answer the question, what do I make of evil? And if you're an atheist, you have to answer that question as an atheist with the resources that the atheistic worldview has to offer. What are you going to say? Well, things happen that are different from people's evolution? I don't think that's going to help. But you don't have money resources to work with. So the real issue regarding the problem of evil for me and the way I approach this, and I am encouraging you to think about it, is who has the best answer, the best explanation for the way things are. Even if that leaves some things unanswered, which I think is always going to be the case regarding this question, and certainly this hour, which is one third gone already. Even if I don't tie up every loose end, which I will not, and I haven't done for myself, the question is who has the best explanation, given that we all have to give an answer in light of our understanding of the big picture. Which way of understanding the world first can best make sense of the challenge, all right? I mean, in some worldviews, the problem's not even intelligible. I'll get to that in a moment. And secondly, which way of looking at reality offers the resources to deal with the problem? So what I want to do here is I just want to look at a couple of things, suggest some ideas for you to get you thinking by way of laying a foundation for, I think, productive thought about the problem of evil, especially as it touches on the question of the existence of God. And I want to begin by making just a couple of observations that I think is going to simplify the problem. And what I mean by that is, ironically, I think the problem itself gives us some clues about the answer to the problem. Sometimes when you just look at the thing closely, then you realize, well, some answers are still in the running, but other answers are no longer in the running now that we've dialed down and focused in a little bit. And I think that's going to happen. And then I want to show you that on the Christian view, there simply is no contradiction between the existence of God, a good God, and a powerful God, and the existence of evil. In other words, it's not the problem for us that people think it is. But that's, you're going to have to get inside of the Christian worldview in order to see that, which is the appropriate way to do it, by the way. If somebody says you have a contradiction within your worldview, then the way to show that we can beat that charge is to have the objector get into our worldview with us and see how the objection or the apparent contradiction is resolved within our worldview. Now, this doesn't mean our worldview is true. What it means is it can't be faulted in virtue of contradiction if we can show that proper understanding of our worldview resolves the apparent contradiction. All right. And then finally, I want to show, and maybe I'll only have a few moments to do this at the end, the kind of thing that God is doing to solve the problem. So that speaks to the existential question, the question that was offered. That is the real question. Well, in our hearts, what is God doing in our lives when we face the personal issue? How do we answer the challenge of Bertrand Russell? How are you going to talk about God when you're kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Okay, and what I'm aiming for in my own assessment is that the answer to evil is not atheism. In fact, I think atheism is completely counterintuitive when you look closely at the issues. It's intuitive in terms of the emotional response, but not in terms of the intellectual issue itself. The answer isn't atheism. It's just the opposite. The answer to evil is God, and specifically, I think, God in Jesus on a cross at Calvary. So let me start with a couple of observations, all right? The first observation is really straightforward. Evil is something, okay? Of course, it's something. That's why we got the problem, is maybe what you're thinking. But I want you to be thinking about the nature of the objection, because how is it that the objection is put? How could there be a powerful good God if there's so much evil in the world? Now, notice how this is characterized. It's evil in the world. Those words are not idle words, okay? It's not a throwaway phrase like you can do without it, because the objection to the problem of evil only is meaningful if there is evil in the world. Why do I keep emphasizing that phrase? Because there's a whole lot of people who, when it comes to the question of morality, think that the distinction between good and evil is something that is only in the mind of the subject. Okay? Let me say that again. The distinction between good and evil is only in the mind of the subject. Okay, that's why it's called subjectivism. Somebody says, who are you to push your morality on me? All right, what's the implication there? The implication is that morality is simply an individual matter. I have my rules, you have your rules, and there are no rules over everybody. Now, this is called moral relativism, and you've heard the phrases, and you're familiar with the notion, because people play this card all the time, especially when somebody passes a kind of judgment, a moral judgment, on someone else's behavior. And they get offended. Who are you to do that? And what is it that they mean? They mean that you are taking your private preference, set of preferences, your own moral code, and you're acting as if your moral code ought to be my moral code. But that isn't how morality works. It doesn't structure like that. There is no moral code for everybody that you can impose on me. You have yours, I have mine. Okay, that's the point of view. And that's just another way of describing moral relativism. Morals are relative to the subject who believes them, and that's it. So there is no set of laws over everybody, objectivism. There are no laws out there that people violate. There are only the laws I have inside of me for myself for the moment. And you have yours and I have mine, and so who are you to push yours on me? Now notice, if this is the view that people hold, and many do hold that, at least superficially, I want to make an observation. They are welcome to their relativism, but they cannot help themselves at the same time to the problem of evil. Because moral rules can't be out there and not out there in the world at the same time. The objection about evil in the world requires there to be evil in the world. That is, rules broken out there, outside of us, irrespective of our opinions. But relativism says that morality just is our opinions, and that's all that we can say about it. Okay, choose one or the other. You can't have both, because they contradict. Either morality is subjective or not. If it's not subjective, it's objective. It's absolute in some sense. It's outside of us. It's mind independent, or at least our mind independent. One or the other. Take your choice. Choose your poison. You want to be a relativist? Fine. No problem of evil. You want to complain about the problem of evil? Fine. I get that. You can't defend relativism. Relativism is incoherent in that sense. On that view, one or the other. Now, the relativist has one of two choices here. He can bite the bullet and say there is a problem of evil and surrender his relativism, or he can cling to his relativism and surrender the problem of evil. But he can't do both if he's going to be intellectually honest. And surrendering the problem of evil is hard because it's so obvious that there's evil in the world, and it's also one of the favorite objections of critics of theism. Okay? So that's the problem. That's the first observation. There's got to be evil out there. That means morality has to be objective in some sense. Now, this is sometimes hard for people to sink their teeth into, so let me just give you some illustrations for it. There's this wonderful speedway. No, it's not a speedway. It's a highway, which actually is a de facto speedway in Germany called, you know it, the Autobahn. So here's my question. Can you break the speed limit on the Autobahn? The answer is, of course not. Why not? Because there are no speed limits on the Autobahn. Now, somebody told me that might have been changed recently, or if you have a commercial vehicle, that's different, blah, blah, blah. But you get my point. You cannot break a law that does not exist. Okay? Now, I've actually driven on the Autobahn, and that was a lot of fun, and I went really fast in a rental car for a short distance because it got scary. You can't break a law that doesn't exist. Okay? That's the essence of relativism. Relativism says there are no laws. There are no universal speeding laws. Therefore, you can't break those universal speeding laws if they don't exist. Pretty straightforward. Okay? So, therefore, there can't be any law breaking, and therefore, no evil if relativism is true. If there is law breaking, it can only be if there are laws that are broken. And by the way, I can't think of a simpler way to put it, because it seems so self-evidently true. If relativism is true, there is no problem of evil. And this is why when I gave the syllogism, the moral argument for the existence of God, I was careful to qualify it. If there is no God, there is no objective evil. But there is objective evil, that is, the problem of evil. Therefore, there must be a God. Now, I haven't finished cashing that out. I just want you to see that I was careful to make my case based on objective evil, because that's the only kind that matters. I mean, who would object to God who just doesn't do what they like unless it was really wrong? That would be like saying, I can't believe in God. Why not? Brussels sprouts. What do Brussels sprouts have to do with it? Those things taste disgusting, which I agree with that, but I don't understand how that has anything to do with God's existence. Well, how I can't believe in a God that would make something so disgusting to my taste. See, that's what the problem of evil reduces to in a relativistic world. Okay, so first observation, if there is a problem of evil in the world, then it's in the world. That means there must be laws that are broken that are objective, and therefore relativism must be false. If relativism is true, there's no problem of evil. First point. We know there is a problem of evil, so relativism is false. Here's the second point. All right, we got those laws. Where did those laws come from? Is the second point. And this needs to be answered. And I know a lot of people want to go to Darwin and use Darwin. Well, it came from Darwinism, but you haven't escaped the problem of relativism when you do that. Because if Darwinism is true, that means that natural selection, some materialistic, mindless process that did not have us in mind or morality in mind, simply arbitrarily produced a belief in us that certain actions are good and certain are bad. There is a difference between virtue and vice, because that belief nets out us being more effective in getting our genes into the next generation. I mean, that's the model. That's the story. Okay. But you understand that a materialistic process like that can only produce beliefs inside the subject in whom the process is taking place. It can't produce anything in the exterior world. It can't make rape wrong or murder wrong. It can't make kindness a virtue. It can't do anything objectively. It can only do something subjectively. Now, if you expand that individual view of morality, individual relativism, if you will, to a group, so it's, well, it's not me individually, it's our group deciding for the betterment of culture or whatever, well, okay, that's the social contract. Still, it's you haven't escaped subjectivism, because you've just expanded the subject from being an individual to being a group of individuals. It's still subjectivism, because no group of individuals can make any act wrong. It can only declare an act wrong for them for the time. And later on, when they change their views, they can change their moral categories. So there was a time when homosexuality was viewed as wrong, and now it's a time where it's viewed as right. I actually had Michael Shermer, the American atheist, in the debate I did with him a number of years ago on radio, claimed that he was a moral objectivist, but then characterized morality in this way as a result of evolution and social contract. And so, therefore, we used to think homosexuality is wrong, objectively wrong. Now we believe it's objectively right. Well, of course, if that's the way it happened, well, then there's nothing objective about it when you're talking about objective morality. It's all subjective. We, as subjects, believe it was objectively wrong, and now we change the rules. Now we believe it's objectively right. But even though we apply the word objective to it, don't you see it's not objective at all? Because if it were objective, then it would be the same all the time. Just like rape is wrong all the time, not just because our culture says it's wrong. And by the way, when you think about it, that actually is a more effective way of getting your genes into the next generation. So it doesn't seem to make sense in that particular case that the Darwinian model can explain it. Suffice to say, though, if you opt for either Darwinism or for social contract, both of those are subjectivistic, relativistic characterizations of morality. They are mind-dependent, either the individual mind or the collective mind, and they have nothing to do with the outside world. In either of those cases, you have no genuine and true problem of evil. You have a false belief that people hold regarding evil, or an arbitrary definition of evil that the group makes. That's it. That's all you can say about it. But it seems like there's more to say about it, doesn't it? it seems like evil's out there, which is what the complaint is, evil in the world. And therefore, neither Darwinism nor the social contract is adequate to explain its existence, where the laws came from. We still need we need a source for the law. And by the way, this is a very different thing than knowing what the law is. I know Chris Hitchens used to say, making his case against this argument, the moral argument for the existence of God, he'd say, just show me one good thing that you can do as a believer in God that I can't do as an atheist. That was his challenge. Now, his challenge was completely misguided. Incidentally, there is an answer to that, and the answer is you can't glorify God. I'm chuckling because it just goes to show that it doesn't. Your morality does make a difference whether you believe in God or not, because according to theists, the summum bonum, the greatest good, is bringing glory to God. Now, of course, an atheist would disagree with that, fine, but it just shows that our value systems are different. But even in the place where they might intersect, he's missing the point. This isn't a discussion about what you can do and what you can know. Yes, you could act in ways that I call kind and virtuous. You can do those things. I could do those things, even though you're an atheist. But that's not the point. That's like saying, look, you know, you can drive 35 miles an hour down my street, and I can drive 35 miles an hour down my street, which is great. It's true. Both can do that. But, you know, it's only keeping the law if there is a law that says that 35 miles per hour is the limit. You can drive that speed, but if there's no law that says that's the limit, then you're not a law keeper. You're just a slow driver. That's pretty good. I never thought of that one before. You're just a slow driver. You're not a law keeper. You can't be a law keeper unless there's a law. And that's the question here. For Chris Hitchens, it's not whether you can do the actions, it's the intelligibility of the goodness of the actions themselves. So if there is no God, then he can't do good, and neither can I as the Christian theist who believes falsely in God. If there is a God who sets the standard, then I can do good as a theist, and so could he as a person who doesn't believe in God. Because there is a God, actually, that ultimately grounds it. It's kind of like Christopher Hitchens saying, I don't believe in writers, people who write things. And so I might say, well, look at how can you read anything then? He said, I can read just fine. I can read better than you. Watch me. Here I go. I'm going to read something. Well, that misses the point, you see. So this isn't the epistemological question of how you know what's good or bad, or whether you can, in the pragmatic question, whether you do the actions. It's really the ontological question, metaphysical issue of what makes those things good to begin with. And that's where you get to this concern that I'm raising. That is, you have to have a law maker that is adequate to the task, that has the appropriate authority to make laws for the whole world. And this is where God comes in. There's no other option. The only one I've ever heard is a kind of a moral Platonism, and that has its own problems, but I've almost never in my life talked to a moral Platonist who has opted for that. So the common sense notion, the best explanation for the way things are, is that if there is evil in the world, that's because transcendent laws have been broken in the world, and the transcendent laws need a transcendent lawmaker, therefore there must be a God. Now, this is the way C.S. Lewis argues in the beginning of Mere Christianity. It's the way Frank Beckwith and I argue in the last chapter of Relativism. It's the way I argue when I deal with this in multiple chapters in The Story of Reality. There must be a God. That's the best explanation for the way things are. Now, that doesn't answer the questions about how good and powerful God can allow such a thing, and I want to get to that next. But I just want you to see that just looking at the question shows you that relativism is false if there is evil in the world, and atheism is false if there is evil in the world. And if atheists, I challenge them. You tell me then what you mean by evil. What is evil, real evil, if there is no God? And one conversation I had with an atheist on the air here was that his response to my question, evil is just not doing what your evolution tells you to do. Really? Why do I have an obligation to obey my evolution? Huh? Do you see how that trivializes the concept of evil? In any event, I want to go to the next issue, though. And that is, well, people say, look, okay, if evil's real, it's something. Well, then God created it. God made everything. Evil is a thing. Therefore, God made evil. Okay, that's another problem. And there's a legitimate response to that. And the response is that you're misunderstanding the nature of evil. Evil isn't a thing. Because if it was a thing, in the sense that you mean, well, then your argument would go through and that would create problems for us. But that isn't the way that Christians have argued for almost 2,000 years. Augustine argued differently, and he argued differently for a reason when you reflect on the nature of the thing. When God made everything, he said that it was good. What did he mean by good? It meant that everything was working just exactly the way he intended it to work. Okay? And then what happened? Through the disobedience of human beings, the world got broken. I think it's the best, simplest way of thinking about it. As parents, we give our children boundaries because we understand how the world works. You get outside of the boundaries, you break something. Maybe a dish or a vase or a papa's tool. Maybe a relationship. Maybe you break a whole life. Sometimes the breakage is irreparable. So we understand kind of how this works, though we're imperfect because we're just ordinary folk. Even so, it gives you an idea how this works. Well, God's not an ordinary folk. He is perfect. He knows precisely how the world works because he made it. And he gives us boundaries to operate within. And when we violate those boundaries, something breaks. And this is exactly what happened at the beginning. It was all made good. It was all just the way it was supposed to be. And then there was a violation, disobedience, and brokenness. Relationship with God was broken. Relationship with other humans was broken. Relationships with environment was broken. Everything's got broken. And then a broken world produces broken things. So we live in a broken world. But we understand how that happened. In our worldview, it's because human beings make a choice. So evil's not a thing like that. I sometimes ask people, did you ever eat a donut hole? No, I don't mean one of those little round gut bombs that you get at church after the service in the back with the coffee. No, I mean a donut hole. You say, no, I've never eaten a donut hole. Why not? Well, a donut hole is where the donut ain't. You can't eat a donut hole. That's right. So the hole is something, but it's not something. A shadow is something, but it's not something. It's where the light ain't. It's a privation of light. Donut holes are the privation of donut. And evil is a privation of good. It's where goodness leaks out. It's a hole in goodness. Okay? That's why we say unrighteous, because not righteous. That's why sin, hamartia in the Greek, is a picture of missing the mark. You fall short of the glory of God, Paul says in Romans 3, I think. And so we all have this sense that there is a failing, a shortcoming. That's what evil amounts to. It's not a thing. It's something missing. It's a brokenness. And the way I have been characterizing this recently, it was a lot of fun last weekend when I did this in Las Vegas. I always ask somebody for a pencil in the audience. Can I borrow a pencil? And here's a young man, probably 8 years old, sitting in the front row. I actually saw his pencil in his packet there. He was taking notes. I saw, okay. So Timmy jumps up and hands me his pencil. God bless his heart. And then I point out to the audience, this is a good pencil. Yes, it does what it's intended to do, which is what goodness entails. God made the world to work a certain way. It's working that way. It's good. It's all good. Genesis 1. Okay, then I held up the pencil to the audience. And I said, now watch. And then I snapped the pencil right in half. Of course, there's gasps and looks of horror, and Timmy doesn't know what to do. I say, is this pencil good anymore? No, it's not good. Wait, has anything disappeared from the pencil? No, all the pencil is still there. Is there anything new that's created? No, everything's the same as it was before, but now it just doesn't work. There you go. This is a picture of goodness. Then, of course, I handed the broken pencil back to Timmy and said, thank you very much. he was actually very good-spirited about it, you know. He might save that, you know, I don't know, sell it on eBay in a year. Yeah, Amy says she hopes that I bought extra pencils. I did have an extra pencil, but actually somebody else from the staff brought one to him and gave it to him, you know. But he was in good spirit. But you get the picture. It's a very good, vivid picture of what we're talking about. We talk about what evil amounts to. It's a brokenness. Now, how did this brokenness happen? It happened when human beings made a choice to disobey God. So here we come to the potential contradiction. How can a good God who is powerful allow evil in the world? And there are, I will tell you right now, there are different ways to answer this question. But I also want you to see that you don't have to have the right answer to parry the objection. All you have to have is a possible answer. Because remember, the objection is there is a necessary contradiction in your view, and all we have to show is, given that kind of objection, it ain't necessarily so. And once we demonstrate it ain't necessarily so, that is, maybe there is a good reason that God allowed evil, maybe for a season, well, then the objection itself falters. It's more than falters. It fails completely, which is why, by the way, it is very difficult to find a working philosopher who is going to use this argument against God, the deductive argument against God, because they know you can't actually form a valid syllogism to demonstrate that there could be no God based on evil. And it's principally because it's clear that the statement, if God were really good, he would not allow evil, is a false statement. There are all kinds of scenarios that people can offer of why why God might have allowed evil, at least for a season, and still have a morally sufficient reason to do so. Now, the free will argument is an example of that. Some people like it, some don't. Alvin Plantinga kind of made it famous. But it certainly is a possibility that God did something good, that is, he gave human beings free will, which means evil was possible, though not necessary, not inevitable, certainly possible, because that is the nature of moral freedom, or at least the kind of moral freedom that God had given human beings. And I argue this way in The Story of Reality, though I make clear that this is just a possibility. This is what many people have offered as an example of the kind of morally sufficient reason that God could have had to create a kind of world in which human beings could do evil, okay? And he's not going to be able to create a world where people are morally free in that sense and cannot do evil, because that's like trying to make a square circle. Moral freedom just is the possibility of doing evil. And so that's the kind of world that God has made, and he's made it for the reason of human liberty and freedom. Now, there are other reasons that you might consider that God might have thought that allowing evil was adequate, was okay. In other words, morally sufficient reason for that. And I'm not going to go into all of that because it's not necessary. It's all that's necessary for us to show is that there is a possible reason for that. And I think there are a number of examples of that. Now, some people may ask the question, well, was it worth the price? Maybe there's just more evil than can be justified. Okay? That's a different kind of argument. That's called the inductive problem of evil. And this requires, this is a little different take. Okay, maybe it's not a contradiction, but it's just unlikely that there is a God given all the evil in the world. Now, in light of that objection, keep in mind that the atheist is still strapped with the same problem, the coherence of the word evil to begin with, if there is no God. But there's something else that's a problem here. And this something else is the idea that who would be in the best position to know whether or not it was worth it? Whether there's too much evil to be justified by some potential moral reason. Certainly not us, because we're not omniscient. God is in the best position to determine that. And we don't have that picture. Now, I was talking to somebody recently and said, well, that's just very convenient for you. I said, it's not just, it is, well, I don't know if you can call it convenient or not, but I'm not saying this as a feature of convenience, but as a legitimate response to the charge. Oh, think about this. Greg Gansel gave me this illustration. I got it from his book, and I think it's a good one. I have it in The Story of Reality. If there is an elephant in the room, virtually everybody in the room would be in a position to know that, because that's pretty obvious if it's true. But if we change the elephant to a gnat and we ask, or a flea, and said, is there a flea in the room? Well, that's a lot harder to tell. You can go looking around and you might find a flea, but even if you found no fleas, it doesn't mean that there are no fleas in the room, because fleas are kind of hard to find. And they could be hidden somewhere, even that you don't see it. So you have an epistemic limitation of determining that. So the question regarding the possibility of too much evil is really not an elephant kind of question. That is the question we'd be able to answer just by looking at things and know for sure. It's more like a flea kind of question, a flea in the room kind of question. That is, there might be a justification that we just don't know about. And I think most Christians can bear testimony to the idea that that as they look back in their lives, they see evils that have happened to them. That is, things that were anguishes and suffering that took place in their life that at the time they wondered, how could God allow this in my life? And later on down the line, they look over their shoulder and they see the outcome of it for good, and the outcome is a greater good than the evil that they experienced in the moment. And so they're able to see, in hindsight, the morally sufficient reason God had for allowing that. I think virtually every Christian who's been around for a while has experienced something like that. And why isn't that an adequate or a fair rejoinder to the inductive challenge about the problem of evil? I think it is. So I think we're within our rights here. Even if some people don't think the T's are all crossed there, or the I's are all dotted, we still are, I think, offering an explanation that is reasonable. So I think we can sidestep the so-called contradiction from within a Christian worldview, remember? And that's what we have to do. We have to get inside the worldview to show that we have an explanation that makes sense. It's in play. It's plausible, all right? But I think we can do better than that. Because remember I said earlier that since everyone has to deal with the problem of evil, the real question is, what worldview offers the best solution? What worldview makes the most sense, not only out of evil's existence, but can be best situated to give us solutions, comfort, and realistic hope? So I want to go back just for a brief moment to Bertrand Russell, who said, how can you talk about God when you're kneeling at the bed of a dying child? And when I first heard that challenge, I was really set back on my heels. I didn't know what to say. Then I heard William Lane Craig's response, the Christian philosopher. He said, what is the atheist Bertrand Russell going to say when he's kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Tough luck? Too bad? That's the way it goes? No happy ending? No silver lining? Nothing but devastating, senseless, well, you can't even call it evil, I think. Something that you don't like. The atheists are struck dumb while kneeling at the bed of a dying child because they cannot speak of the patience and the mercy of God. They cannot mention the future perfection that awaits all who trust in Christ. They cannot offer the comfort that a redemptive God is working to cause all things to work together for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. They have no good news of hope for a broken world. Their worldview denies them anything but tormented silence. We have a lot to say. All of those things. We are not struck mute. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it's hard. Yes, sometimes we can't figure it out. Yes, sometimes all we have is what Paul said. Momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory. It doesn't feel momentary in the moment. It doesn't feel light in the moment. But taken in terms of eternity, which is the way that Paul is speaking there in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18, Taken in those terms, small and light, and especially compared to the eternal, everlasting weight of glory that results. So God is doing something about evil. He's going to eventually change the whole world. He's going to solve the problem of evil. That's the end of the story, but we're not at the end of the story. Our story's not over yet. Evil's part of our story, but our story's still in play. What's happening now? God is patient. He is long-suffering, not willing that any perish, but all come to repentance. That, 2 Peter. This is the time for people to turn to Christ and receive the mercy that he offers as opposed to the judgment they deserve. Because think about it, if Jesus were to come back now, tonight, at midnight, to set it all right, where would a whole bunch of people, maybe you or your friends or your family, be at 1201? As C.S. Lewis points out, when the author walks on the stage, the play is over. When he deals with evil, he's going to do a complete job. And for those who have not received mercy, there is only one thing left: perfect justice. It's either perfect mercy or perfect justice. That's what's left. And what God is doing now in this time, and this is the message we have, we can make sense of the problem of evil. It fits into our story. Our story is not over yet. It's going to be dealt with in the long term. Our whole story is about the problem of evil. God's going to fix it. But first, he fixes us, because we are the ones who contribute most to the problem of evil. It's a human problem, and we are guilty. Our fingerprints are on the smoking gun. And so what he offers now is not judgment, but mercy. And that's the answer to the problem of evil. That's the answer we can offer to others. Mercy in the long term, help in the moment, in the midst of a fallen world. It's the best explanation for the way things are. I'm Greg Kochel. This is Stand to Reason. Thanks for listening. Give them heaven. Bye-bye.